The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of LOF. And today we are speaking with Mike Sia, Assistant Professor of Vascular Surgery over at UT Southwestern, and also our good friend Sean Chakrabarty, a CMO at Lymphflow, a company recently acquired by Inari. And I think you'll find it super interesting, some of their perspectives from the origins, the conception, the acquisition, all the way up to strategy, ethos, company, culture, penetration, education, and future applicability of the Lymphflow transcatheter deep venous arterialization device. So I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you also, Lucas, thoughts on this?
Yeah, it was, again, a great conversation. We kind of discussed the whole process that Inari went through to and the kind of thought process of why they would want to acquire Lymphflow, which is very interesting. And then we just talked about the technology, where it's been, where we think it's going to go. I had some hot takes at the end, so hopefully I don't get too many hate messages on it. And yeah, I thought it was great.
All right, let's go.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
All right, everybody. Thank you for staying. The intro was done. And so you know who I am speaking to today. And let's just take out the conversation with one thing that was a little bit surprising for me. When I heard of the official announcement of the Inari acquisition by, of the Lymphflow acquisition by Inari, I was honestly a little perplexed. I thought, well, these guys do DVT and PE, and this is a very particular CLTI solution. And at the time, it just didn't click to me. And of course, I've had some great conversations with leadership since then that have made it clear to me why this made more sense. But I'd like you, Sean, to help our audience who maybe don't have that perspectives of understanding a little bit maybe what Inari was conceptually, because I know it's a very early company too, relative like Lymphflow. But how did that start as a company? What was the ethos and the conception? And then how would that pivot eventually, you know, kind of grow me into why did that make sense in a portfolio that just didn't quite fit, at least to us lay people outside?
Yeah, listen, I think it's an excellent question. And you know, Miguel, it's been about 3 years since I joined Inari. And I think framing the culture and ethos of that company kind of helps tell the story and maybe makes a little more sense of the acquisition. You know, Inari, and the reason I really joined was their culture and competency around identifying big unmet patient, not small ones, but big unmet patient needs that don't have good contemporary solutions. So PE is a good example, right? Inari is a younger company. I think that most people realize it spun off of an incubator back in 2011, actually, not that long before Lymphflow's start. And you see those trajectories, right? But the whole idea was pulmonary embolus is a disease state that's pretty inadequately treated, and a coagulation, very morbid procedure, which is surgical thrombectomy. And really the Inari story started with innovating around that disease state. And most importantly, building a purpose-built solution. And I think that's sort of a differentiator. And this will loop back to the Lymphflow story, trust me. But purpose-build is important. You know, success in PE didn't come from repurposing another device for that vascular bed or for that disease state. It came from iteration and maybe most importantly, Miguel, Mike, Lucas, getting feedback from physicians like yourself and re-innovating. And you know, if you took a look at the FlowTriever catheter's early stages, it would not at all resemble what you see today. And that's a product of that, you know, constant feedback loop from physician and user input. And then, of course, behind that, an evidence base, right? An ever-expanding evidence base to show safety and efficacy, which is a big commitment for the company. So all those things were important in terms of me coming over full-time. Again, 3 years ago, seems like a long time ago. And Inari really has built some muscle since then. You know, quite an evolution in the Inari story, right? IPO in 2020, going in independently, maintaining that freedom and agility that allowed for commercialization and now global expansion pretty quickly. We're now at a stage where looking for more unmet patient needs, right? And innovating is one way to get there. And there's other disease states that Inari is certainly dipping its toe in now, dialysis access management, chronic venous disease, which obviously has some commercial overlap with this sort of wound world that CLTI was operating in. But I think a recognition that, hey, you know, other people are doing this too. And I think LimFlow is a really successful story in that they also have identified a tremendous unmet patient. Not just CLTI, but in this case, no option CLTI patients that are otherwise chronic recognition have developed a very innovative solution and that is very much purpose-built, similar to the Inari story, right?
When did it get in your radar? Yeah.
When
did LimFlow get in your radar?
Pretty early on. I can't necessarily give specifics on when we first started engaging with them. But suffice to say, pretty well ahead of the acquisition date, and then a pretty prolonged diligence process, you know? So a good sense that, wow, these guys kind of follow the same ethos. And, you know, Lucas, one thing we realized during that diligence process, and we definitely talked to Miguel a few times during that process, it seemed like the next steps for LimFlow kind of matched up really well with what Inari's good at, right? So, it is in the endovascular space. So there's definitely an overlap there. There's an overlap in the users to some extent. I mean, we've already engaged certainly with vascular surgery, IR, interventional cardiology, the folks that do this procedure, maybe getting more close to the vascular surgery community as we started entering the chronic venous disease space. But now really trying to engage the CLTI community. And those competencies that I think LimFlow needed to get to the next level include this sort of early commercialization muscle, investment in clinical research, focus on program building. And those are the sort of things that I think made both parties realize this is a potentially a really good marriage. And Inari then has the opportunity to branch into a new disease state, become a platform company as opposed to just a only VTE-focused company. And stay tied to that ethos and that culture around identifying big unmet patient needs and building purposeful solutions. So, long answer, Miguel, but we got there.
No, that's really it's really important. And I'll tell you from my perspective, and I'd love to hear Mike's perspective on this. But when Inari steps into the ring, one of the things that was almost abrasive, to be very honest, was this notion that there should be ultimate control of the right parties in order to develop the programs. And I later then became actually rather impressed and enamored with that. But initially it was like, whoa, because I felt that, you know, for example, I got an invite. I remember one of the first interactions I had with a company many years ago was I got invited to speak with a VP of, I want to say something like product and acquisitions or something of the hospital to meet with the manager of, or the VP of Inari. And I didn't even know who this person was. And I felt that as a doctor, you should talk to me first. Why are you going up the chain of the hospital without first engaging me? Which was in a way kind of dumb. I mean, you know, but it was just so out of the norm, right? We are you need the doctor to be your expert, and you need me to be the one that signs off to get the product through the evaluation committee. You need to make me convinced before we go up there. And something that I think you guys did that was very different that sets you apart from everybody else is you said, listen, this is a global problem and an economic problem. I mean, there's a clinical need, but there's also a lot of money that's being wasted. And it's important for us to make the case with the hospital that there is an economic question here that could be addressed. And it can permeate from the top to the bottom, not necessarily always, or let's say horizontally, not the doctors are below, but let's say that it just was coming from different pathways. Yeah. And then I also got invited to a meeting with a bunch of ED folks from remote places, unbeknownst to me also, where it was then creating a network, right? So it was like, you guys were attacking the C-suite, you guys were attacking the feeders, and then in the middle, you know, I became like kind of part of this, but it was all somewhat unbeknownst to me. And initially I was like very resistant to that. But then I was like, huh, this actually made it really easy to get the product through. And it made it easy for me to be able to get it. And now I get it. And I think it worked wonders. I don't know, Mike, if you felt that difference in Inari as a company and the way that they penetrated the hospital. Did you feel that kind of C-suite level and then like the bottom kind of thing, or was your experience different?
I think my experience was different just with respect to, you know, Inari. I trained at a place that did a very high volume of ETE. So I was very familiar and very comfortable with the product. So when I ultimately came here to Dallas, you know, when I was thinking about adding to our clinical volume, our clinical practice here, ET wasn't a big thing that we were doing. So it was actually me trying to bring in an RA and developing relationships with the VTE reps here. So it was very easy, very seamless. We were able to bring all those things in. The IR program here using an RA. So I didn't really get attacked from above and below. But when it comes to limb flow, I mean, for me, as someone who wasn't involved with the initial trials, dogs are going crazy. But as somebody who wasn't involved with the initial trials, someone who initially started doing the arterialization of veins using off-the-shelf products, you know, to me, when I found out that Inari was acquiring LimFlow, I was happy because I thought it was going to be a pathway to get this technology in my hands because I didn't have early access. So to be honest, I was like, I don't care. Like, this is good. This is good for my patients. This is good for me. So that's my sort of perspective on it.
And I guess that's the point I guess I'm trying to make. And I'd love to hear Lucas's experience also with how this kind of panned out on the local level. But what I felt was, if you understand that these guys get it, right? They understand that there is a need, there's a niche, but there's also the need to coordinate vertically in the institution, and then the need to accommodate a system of feeders that you have to reorganize. Now, think about CLTI, the no option, right? First is a huge cost problem. Amputations aren't cheap. There's a misconception in the system that amputations are super cheap for the hospital. And then the fact of the matter is, if you do build a program for these very particular patients, you need a very strong network of support because you're going to need the wound care folks. You're going to need the podiatry folks. You're going to need all these people, the home health. And so there's a very structured coordination that needs to happen. And for me, when I think about what Inari had to do on the DVT, you know, VTE part, like it just makes sense that even though, yes, it seems like they're two different things, when you think about what's going to be needed, it makes sense. And I mean, I don't know, Lucas or Sean, what your thoughts are about that strategy. I just think that it's a good marriage.
Yeah, after the acquisition, I kind of lost touch with, at that point, Inari.
Get it closer to the mic first.
And then I've been re-engaging lately. There have been some turnover, I think, in the support here in Austin. But we're trying to
build it, build the network with the company to get the word out. You know, we were part of the Promise 2 trial, so that really helped get me familiar with it. Mike, I had a question to go back to a previous topic about the acquisition. You know, the learning curve I found, especially at the point where I got involved, was pretty steep to get this to work. Lots of nuances, not so much the procedure, though the procedure has some learning curves, but more like the management afterwards. Was that at all in your consideration as far as, you know, this is not the easiest technology to implement in the real world. Did that come into play when you guys were thinking of it? Oh, this works, it's great, but, you know, it requires a lot of upfront work from the physician, from us, from the supportive staff, and from the hospital.
Question. I think that this type of therapy, at least for me, occupied a very unique place in my sort of approach to patients. You know, the only reason why I started doing these procedures was because I felt like I didn't have good solutions for patients. And I'm sure you guys think the same way as I do. There's some situations where amputations are the right thing to do for patients, but more often than not, you know, it always breaks my heart a little bit. I'm always frustrated. I feel like there was a serious shortcoming of the care I was able to deliver. So the arterialization of the deep venous system in the foot seemed like a frontier that I had to figure out. And not having access to lymph flow from the outset when I started to do these procedures, you know, I was really reliant on, you know, videos on YouTube or, you know, papers from Europe. And one of the really cool things, or probably the most instrumental paper that I came across, was Dr. Miliara's Piker technique. You know, it's so elegantly described in paper form. He's got videos on YouTube. He's like a very charismatic guy. And when I thought about doing his procedures, I didn't really anticipate, or I didn't really recognize the nuances of the postoperative care so much as just thinking about the technical challenges associated with doing something novel, right? It's super novel. So, you know, I reached out to Bruno. You know, I've bothered Miguel at conferences before, trying to learn the nuances to these procedures. And for the first couple of cases, the primary focus I had was just getting through the case. And then the postoperative care, I was very, very, very lucky to sit next to a fantastic foot and ankle surgeon, this guy, Larry Lavery, who I think his approach is very scientific, very thoughtful. He was willing to sort of buck his conventional paradigm about, you know, early closure, tight suture closure, you know, taking these patients to the operating room 4 or 5 times, you know, before definitive closure after these patients. Because we learned that if you put sutures in patients after DVAs, they're not going to do well for the most part. You might get lucky a handful of times, but in general, it's not a good idea. So we were able to learn together. And I think that that made it really easy because I had a partner who was willing to sort of go on that journey with me too. So it just seemed like the logical progression for somebody who's passionate about preventing amputation and taking care of patients with CLTI.
I'd like to ask the same question to Sean from a business standpoint before we completely move out of that topic, which is every time a company, because I've been in board in advisory boards when this comes, it's not. I mean, putting down $400+ million, you know, it's not something you do without really looking into things, right? And so there's usually a lot of debate. There's usually a lot of calculations. Mm-hmm. Do you feel, and I know that this may be, you know, one of the first times that you were involved in a big acquisition like this, but did you feel that there was a lot of internal debate, a lot of people that were maybe not for or against? Or was it more of a hell yeah, this is something that's great for us and it should just run passes every sniff test. Yeah. I don't know how much, of course, you can share from the internal process, but what was that like a little bit? What you can share?
Let me just screen share the board minutes. No, I'm kidding. listen, it was there was definitely I think with any acquisition, I would hope it with a competent company, a good deal of debate. But think about the tailwinds of LimFlow. So you did a great job, Miguel, describing why program building is important to novel therapy and how just manufacturing a device and selling it to really good operators like you guys is insufficient to grow a market and to reach all the patients that you can potentially reach, which is really the name of the game. We celebrate milestones in terms of patients treated, and that doesn't happen without this sort of community of collaborators, right? Account managers, national account managers that work with the IDNs on contracts, clinical evidence generation folks out in the field, all these sorts of, all this milieu of people working together. I'd like to think, hopefully, you guys, the physician, is still the center of all of that. I certainly wouldn't want any of those people working around you, rather with their physician champions. But to get to the question of the internal discussion, here are the tailwinds for LimFlow, right? As Mike pointed out, a therapy that's been explored for a long time with non-purpose-built tools that now has a dedicated toolkit that really has no other solution for this particular group of patients. So that's one. Purpose-built solution is done, and the feedback is, for folks like you and other docs who reached out to you at Diligence, this works and it works better. The second is there meat on the bone? Is there patients there, right? That's something we always think about when we think about entering a new, we use the acronym TAMP, total addressable market, right? So how big is the TAMP? In this case, it was about, take US only, Miguel, about 500,000 CLTI patients in the US, right? A year, never mind the prevalent population. Best guess, all things taken into consideration, how many of these folks are no options or prior revasc, no longer have a bypass target or endovascular target and have anatomy amenable to a TADV? We think, let's say conservatively, 10%. And then you have, of course, limbs to think about rather than people. Dr. Sia was telling me a bit about the bilateral cases he'd already done. So we land somewhere like north of 50,000 people a year that could potentially benefit this from this technology. That's meat on the bone, you know? And then you take the other tailwind, which is around the economics, as you described. So already this procedure is considered pretty complex and might just to a fairly complex reimbursement code in terms of the US. But FDA has recognized this technology pre-acquisition as a breakthrough device. So we had a lot of confidence that that this, like many, many great technologies that came before it, would benefit from a new tech add-on payment for a period of time. And that's come to fruition now. Just this past October 1st was the activation for that new tech add-on payment. So technology's good. Reimbursement landscape is good. Big group of patients to help, just in the US we're talking, never mind globally, which blows that number way up. And then the one thing I left out now was great clinical evidence. So the PROMISE study series that was conducted by the LimFlow team, just exemplary. I mean, what an amazing job that was done working with you guys to generate high quality clinical evidence, ultimately that gets published in the premier medical journal, the highest impact factor available in the New England Journal of Medicine. Leading to FDA approval, which was the final linchpin in terms of pulling the trigger on acquisition. So a lot of tailwinds, Miguel. And I think that's why the eyes ended up winning out for all those reasons.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Would you mind just for the audience that don't understand what these payments mean, can you explain just briefly, because I was part of a lot of these meetings. You would be so surprised.
Yes.
Of how archaic and unscientific the process of reimbursement is to CMS. And so before the acquisition, listen to this. You go on these Zoom calls where there could be up to like 50 people because CMS needs to involve community. Okay. There's people from the community, like Rotaries. And then I have to go and present to them what this new technology is. And you get like 2 minutes. And there may be 50 new technologies that are presented to this very random, heterogeneous, educated and uneducated group of people. And you get to do your elevator pitch. And then at the end of the day, they say, okay, well, yes, that's going to be a level two. They're okay. Everybody in agreement. Everybody says, yeah, yeah. And then there's like hands and then the thing goes on and you had your 3 minutes of fame. And if you can't nail it and you can't make it, you don't get any of this. And so it's like, all right, what is it? What code do you get applied to? And so can you just explain very briefly right now as a physician, do you get paid for this procedure? And as the hospital, what does this new payment mean? Because I think this is very important as you're, all the people out there are listening and saying, okay, these are the things that I need to talk to my hospital about, to the leadership. Yes.
Yeah. I think really you have to anchor to value to the program. And I'll give the cliff notes, the unsophisticated, my version of this. There is a webinar done by the internationally known Dr. Z. I don't know if you guys have ever watched one of his webinars, but he is ordained the Taylor Swift of coding and reimbursement because of the site, which I think is a completely appropriate moniker. I mean, the number of people that tuned into this webinar live would blow your mind, guys. Like, it was over 5,000.
We've actually invited him on the podcast. We're waiting for him to say yes.
Oh, yeah.
He would be a brilliant guest.
I'm sure you got to go through like Taylor's agent to get to him.
But no, we invited her too. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, if you get her, can I come back on? Like, kids are, really become a hero. So the cliff notes are, there's a value story here just based on what you said earlier on the podcast, which is amputation prevention. For any CLTI program, I know a lot of the really good ones measure the quality of the program based on the amputation rates at their center. If you're able to bring that down alone, you're actually, you know, never mind the inpatient payment that you get for that surgery, you have tremendous savings from the hospital in terms of all the ancillary care they have to put in for that patient and their clinical course thereafter. I don't have to tell you guys that, but there is an economic story there even before we get the reimbursement for the OneFlow kit, right? The cool thing about new technology in our country, and I will give accolades to CMS for standing up this program, is on top of that great economic story, we need to create or remove disincentives to using new technology and building new programs. Because otherwise, you're going to be stuck with the same tool you were using 20 years ago, right? And your centers won't be able to offer new therapies to their community, which is why I think it makes a lot of sense, Miguel. You got like the Rotaries and the motorcycle clubs and stuff chiming in. So here we have something that we believe in the room, any amputation prevention program should have in their toolkit. But to help that in the early days, as CMS starts to figure out how much this costs and how much they should pay for it, the new tech add-on payment program, they allow the hospital to determine their cost all in anesthesia, hospital bed, lunch that they're serving to the patient after the procedure, all of these things, the tools you use for the TADV versus the reimbursement it's currently mapping to based on how the billers and coders coded your hospital. It goes to a certain DRG, which results in payment to the hospital and work RVUs for you guys. And right now it's mapping to a pretty good DRG. The payment's different based on the payers and the locations, but it's comparable to the other endovascular work you do that takes this long. NTAP takes that and says, okay, if you're in the red with that calculation, we'll make up the difference up to 2/3 of the device cost. So in some cases, NTAP will kick in up to $16,000 as an example, in addition to the DRG payment during this 3-year period. During that 3 years, importantly, and I'll end the really dry reimbursement talk with this. It's important that we bill and code very accurately what we're doing. We're kind of stewards of this therapy now over this course, three years. And if we bill and code correctly, then CMS will get all of the right data to say, okay, this is what it actually cost. And now we're going to create a new class one code specifically for this therapy. And this has been done for many therapies in the past. that makes sense and removes that disincentive more globally. And that comes along with great outcomes and great evidence. So that's a reasonable summary.
And for you, for those of you interested, the ongoing code that we use is 0620Key. And so there is already a code that we are using. And so when I do these procedures, I code that as like a single code for the whole thing. But then I add things like ultrasound guided access, two-level angiography, interpretation, IVUS if needed, and so on, some of those other things. So I think that's also important. But let's pivot a little bit more to the technical development, because, you know, I think, Lucas, you and I have in a way firsthand been involved a little bit from the beginning. I'd love you from your optics to share how we stumbled on our first DBA. Lucas, I was already an attending, and Lucas was I want to say finishing or starting. I don't know where we were, but
I it think felt I was like in that my day last
we were
year.
Both very lost, and it was like the blind leading the blind. We were trying to do a popliteal to a distal target bypass on a lady with some odd vasculitis. Had nothing to go. But you want to give us a quick how we stumbled on that?
Yeah, we're doing a pop to like distal perineal bypass. So we take out the fibula. Well, you know, we're there for a little bit, and then we're looking for the perineal, and we just find this cord, and we can't find a lumen, and we go back to the look at the angiogram, and there's like, oh, maybe something in the PT. So we go, we try to find the PT, we find something, and we plug in the bypass to that. And then when we put the Doppler in, it's just like this extremely low resistance signal. And Miguel just kind of like, I think freaks out a little bit, just takes out the gown, goes outside, and I'm there like, okay, what the hell do we do now? I didn't get it at the beginning that we had plugged into the vein. And then it's like, we plugged into the vein. And then he comes in. It's like, oh, everything's fine. Let's close. Pum, and we close. And I'm like, what the fuck? So then he's like, oh, I called this guy in Italy. And we're going to do this new thing that's venous arterialization. We'll bring him back endo and we'll do a vein lysis tomorrow. And I'm like, cool. All right, let's do it. So I think you called Ferraresi or something. And then we just came back. We did an endo, lysis. The lady had a ton of pain. Afterwards we did a guillotine TMA that relieved the pain. It was all wild. And I was like, what are we doing? And I think you saw her this month or something.
I know.
And that was while. That's 2017 or something like that.
I know. I want to say, was that 2017? Yeah, maybe. Yeah. You know, yeah. I think it was my second year here in Houston. And I remember.
What did you tell Mills that you did?
I think.
Did you tell him?
I'm sure I hid the case. Like I put him in some like remote floor under a hospitalist outside of our service, so he wouldn't even ground on it. You know, those things that we attendings do sometimes to keep the chief out of the issue. But so the thing was 2017, I'd already started seeing, I had heard Steve Kuhn and I had heard Andre talking about that. And I think it was Link that I had seen a live case or something. It already started getting an idea of what needed to happen. And all of a sudden this happened, right? And I'm like, well, fuck me. Now we have a big fistula. And so I just scrubbed out. I scrubbed out. I went to my phone, I rubbed WhatsApp, and I called Roberto Ferraresi, who most of us involved in this call him the godfather of arterialization or modern arterialization, because there's the godfather of the beginning, you know, which was Dr. Lengua. But, you know, Roberto said, Miguel, no problem. A bypass is ready. Tomorrow you rip the valves. Oh, good. No worries. I'll send you videos and a PowerPoint. and he did. And, you know, this is one of the things that I have liked the most about this whole story I've never been involved in a technique or a device that has so many people around the world trying to figure it out and ready to help each other out in the most selfless, really the most selfless way. And I think, you know, when I think about that, I think it's because we all believe truly that people are going to benefit from this and that there's no possible way that I can help all the people out there that need help. And so I think everybody has just not cared about any of these dumb differences. You know, oh, you're IR or you're a vascular surgeon or you're a cardiologist. Like, nobody cares about that. Or you're, you know, I'm training people across the street who are technically my competitors. I don't care. The less I think about that, the more it's going to come doubled and tripled in blessings in different ways. But that was funny. That's how we stumbled, man. And that lady came walking last month. And it's a crazy story, but she's still kicking. She remembers you, Lucas. Anyway, she still has her leg. She came with her daughter. She's a grandmother done now. Her daughter, who was a baby then, has two kids now. It was just crazy how we stumbled on that. But to see firsthand, to then, you know, after that, obviously, I was like, I have to get involved. I pursued it really strongly. I flew to Italy. I was with the guys for a week or two. Then I connected with, the guys from LymphFlow. I was able to help them at a very early stage, trying to figure out how to make this work. You know, at the time, the procedure was taking 4 hours and 5 hours. And so, and you just can't commercialize when you're there, right? And so there was a lot of work that needed to happen. And how do we get this case under 2 hours? You know, what needs to happen? What elements are not there? What parts do we have to remove? And there was so much work put into that. The first versions had a very complex ultrasound-based aligning system that never really worked well. And that changed for the V-Siever and the ARC device, which was a major advancement. The first access was behind the malleolus. Later, we found out that if you can access the lateral plantar distally, then you actually set yourself up for not having to cross valves in the foot in an antegrade fashion, which was always very cumbersome. And we were able to get this procedure down to 90 minutes. I think overall, a 2-hour procedure is what we're looking at. But other than just a remarkable story of how that technique has progressed, it's just how many people around the world have band together. And we have this famous WhatsApp group that was the way that we all kind of got our cases in. I've never been part of something like that. And still today, this is a WhatsApp group that I think has years. And one day, I don't know what we should do, but there should be an exercise, but we should go to a journal and essentially export into ChatGPT all the threads of WhatsApp and say, come up with the bullet points that everybody's made throughout the last 5 years and print all these images and build a beautiful historical piece of information, because never have I seen so many people around the world come together and join with smart ideas. I mean, having a guy or two in a room that is intelligent, but then having all these physicians and engineers and people just trying to figure out has just been something remarkable. Sean, I'm sure you've been somewhat impressed by this, but what have your ideas on this remarkable path of selfless scientific and academic development been?
Yeah, this is exactly what you describe as sort of the dream scenario where medicine meets technology. I think it's the whole reason early adopters, early innovators put time and effort into these sorts of things. And like LymphFlow is a really cool story in terms of the early days you described, early techniques to do this, right? Surgically, intentionally or unintentionally, Lucas, hybrid techniques and endovascular techniques. And I think one thing LymphFlow did really well in the early days was have a really impressive tapestry of advisors that was quite global, Miguel. I mean, that's so impressive. Folks from Spain, Italy, Singapore, the US, all sort of coming together, sharing ideas, sharing early successes, iterating, as you said, that journey going from an ultrasound-based crossing to a purely fluoroscopic crossing, which I'm sure cut a ton of procedure time, and making the tools more usable. So, I mean, to me, this is an exemplary example of medicine meets technology. I'm curious, how the other folks feel about that as compared to other medical technologies they've worked with.
Mike, what's been your experience?
Everything you guys have said, the WhatsApp group is pretty wild because, you know, people are posting tough cases, tough, you know, situations, and the response rate is incredibly rapid and incredibly thoughtful. And there's always like an exchange of ideas, you know, it's never just one person chiming in, which I think is fascinating. As somebody who has been doing these procedures and, you know, not having sort of the subtle nuances of the procedure sort of given to you, no one had that. So we're all figuring this out together. You know, one of the big things that I've always been concerned about was, you know, if I was missing the secret sauce, so to speak, for these cases to consistently get the results we all hope to achieve. And what I've learned and what the WhatsApp group has shown me, and, you know, I went to Italy too, and I got to hang out with Roberto. Trying to find the secret sauce, you know, like it's. I think the questions we all have about how to, you know, you balloon an SFA or you do a fempop bypass, we have very, very predictable expectations of what's going to happen, and we're getting there with DBA, but we're not there, which is why I think this collaboration, this research, this thoughtfulness is just so, so important. And there's so much more work to be done right now. And it's things like the WhatsApp group. It's things like your podcast. It's this exchange of ideas, irrespective of specialty. Like, that's what's going to take this therapy to where it needs to be in 2025 and beyond.
So how would you describe where it is now? And how do you think it's, how would you, if you were to transport yourself in 5 years, how would you give that description in 5 years? Like, what else, you know, where are we now as far as predictability, as far as outcomes? We're 80%, we're at 70%, we're 90%.
I would say that, you know, every prospective trial that is looked at delivering this therapy has demonstrated that over time we're learning because our outcomes are getting better, our patients are doing better. And, you know, with Clarity and the natural history study on these patients, we have a much better idea of what happens to patients who are truly no option when they aren't able to get this type of therapy, right? So we're obviously getting better technically, but, you know, take, for example, when we were all at AMP, you know, for the DVA day, there was a panel of 8 to 10 key opinion leaders in this space. Even just amongst the people on the panel, the questions that are low-hanging are like, how to pick your arterial donor, where to do your arterialization, where to create your fistula. Is a distal DVA better than a proximal DVA? Do we need stentless DVA? How do you do it? What do you do with the donor vessel? Do you balloon the lateral plantar vein after you created your fistula? What outflows enough? How do we predict, you know, a completion arteriogram is going to demonstrate success? When's the best timing of amputation? Do you do a major amputation? Do you wait 4 to 6 weeks? Do you do it at 2 weeks? How much flow is supposed to be going through the stent? You know, I could go on and on. And I think that the people who are doing these procedures are going to base their experience upon their anecdotes, you know? But what needs to happen and what will happen in 5 years is we're going to figure out who the best patients are to do distal DVAs, for example, versus more proximal DVAs. You know, we're going to figure out how much flow is going to predict healing with a high sense of certainty. We're going to have insights into how infection has implications versus a patient with pure ischemia. We're going to figure out, all these questions, right? But it requires us to do the work. It requires us to continue collaborating. And I hope that in 5 years, you know, we'll be able to predict with a good sense of certainty based upon an index arteriogram and vein mapping. If you do a deep vein arterialization, this patient's going to have X amount of, you know, chance of amputation-free survival at 6 months and a year, incorporating all their comorbidities and all that other stuff.
Sean, I think that as you grow and more people are getting accustomed to this, the need for the WhatsApp group may be less. And, you know, the actual logistics of having thousands of people on the chat just don't make sense, right? And so I think those days will eventually come to an end, but I don't want anybody out there to feel excluded in that sense, because obviously that was a need at the time. And a lot of that education is now permeated. But moving forward, how do you see that continuous medical education, maybe obviously from the optics of Inari, in continuing to grow and share all the information we have, all the databases, all the images, all these things that are out there? What's that strategy?
So I think it's a really good question. And the frank answer I'd give you is it's going to take a good deal of investment, and it's investment we're planning on. So in a few forms, Miguel, the first is continuing peer-to-peer high-quality training for people that say, I want to bring this to my community, but I've never done this before. How do we get that operator with great skills from 0 to 100? Right now, we're tackling that in the form of centralized training events. Mike and Miguel, you've both served as faculty at these events. You've had sort of a first look at the community that's starting to come together there, usually 20 to 30 physicians that have gotten the device approvals for their facilities go to a central location, and we do a pretty intensive didactic and mildly hands-on based training. That's really just the beginning for them, because then they're connected to a number of resources thereafter, including you guys for one, but then also some diagnostic ultrasound trainers we have employed with LimFlow, wound care specialists we have employed at LimFlow, and that's continued. It doesn't end up a day of the in-house training. We'll have to keep doing that for a while. You know, at some point, Miguel, I don't know if that's scalable, but I don't think this technology is necessarily going in every OR and every cath lab in the country, right? So I think we can continue to train operators that are interested in this using that sort of peer education model, which is investment. We have to bring people together. We have to get the faculty together. We have to continually iterate the content. Another angle, of course, is supporting more global education initiatives like this podcast, like an Inari-sponsored webinar series, symposia at the major professional conferences that we all go to. And then we need to support new learnings. And one program that I'm really proud of that we've stood up at Inari is the Investigator Initiated Research Program, where we can take great ideas that progress this therapy and fund investigators to do some of the research outside of the walls of Inari to answer some of the questions Mike just brought up. You know, Lucas asked where we are, and I think intraprocedurally, we're in a pretty good spot. I mean, we can pretty predictably get this done. You spoke, Miguel, about duration, procedure duration. We can pretty much get this done pretty reliably in that 2-hour time frame with fairly predictable results that wire out final angiogram we can pretty predictably get to. But I think there's still a lot of learning to do in terms of patient selection, which all of you brought up, and then post-TADV wound management. And I think as we dial those in, then we can really democratize this and reach that big market of patients that we just talked about, hopefully save a lot of limbs. I think product development is also going to be a piece of this, where we look at a few of the other questions that Mike brought up. You know, do we need to evolve the product to cross in different locations based on the patient phenotype? Do we need to address durability, size, all these sorts of things that can expand the number of patients that potentially we could help? So I think that's how we think about it. But the fundamental answer is we have to invest in it as a company, and can't just be on the sidelines and put the product out there. It's going to take a concerted effort with the physician community to educate and train.
You know, I always like saying when I get invited to these courses, some of my opening remarks are always around giving everybody in the room a round of applause for being trailblazers. I do think, even though some of us were there maybe uber early, right, when it wasn't ready, there's still so many unanswered questions that I think everybody that gets in now are really going to be disruptors, right? Are going to be people that are pushing the envelope. And I mean, point in case, Mike, you were alluding to not necessarily being part of the problem as to at all. Yet here you are already, I would say, an international key opinion leader within this, right? And so you've emerged pretty quickly out of the fact that A, of course, you're well-respected and a very smart guy, but B, that there is the need for that, right? That in your micro environment, there's so many people that need it. And to your point, and very well articulated, there are a lot of good questions that need to be answered. And it seems like the answer is not like unreachable, right? It's not like we're trying to figure out how to make plasma motors to go to Jupiter, right? It's stuff that with a little bit of inter-societal collaboration and you know, some money behind it, we can get a lot of data moving forward that could aggregate. And I just feel very optimistic that that environment of sharing, the amount of people that have reached out to me to say, hey, has this been published? And I say, no. How about this thing? No. And are you interested? And I'm like, yes, absolutely. Anything you think is worth looking at it. I mean, AI, can you create models of predictability? Can you, you know, and I think all of it should lead to creating these objective performance goals. You know, Mike Conti has been, you know, one of the people that I've disagreed a lot with, but agreed a lot with. And I think Mike brings a pretty important topic, which is anything you're going to do, you're going to have some performance goals and create the right measurements. And the last thing we need is somebody also being crazy about using this procedure in somebody that has a beautiful bypassable target, right? I mean, that's absolutely not what we want. So creating the guardrails around this so that the right people get it and not the wrong people, I think is going to be very important during the educational phase of this procedure. Lucas, where do you think? I'd like to know where you think. We're here in the last few minutes, but where do you think we're going to be in 5 or 10 years in this?
I think the question that's really the most interesting to me, okay, once we figure out all the nuts and bolts, who to select, how to do it, you know, that seems very logical that we'll figure that out. My question is, do we do this preemptively at some point? I think that's an interesting question. And the answer might be no. Some people might be screaming right now at their, however they're listening to this podcast, like, this guy's insane. But I think that's a very interesting question where you have a patient that has significant disease. I think you have to do something to correct their underlying like hyperinflammatory state. Miguel knows that I'm kind of a zealot as far as like diet and stuff like that. So I think that's all very important. But at some point, the damage is done. Oh my God. At some point, the damage is done. And can this be something that you do preemptively to create neangiogenesis? I would love to hear what you guys think about that. Am I crazy? Am I insane?
I think you are insane, but I think you're also right. I would say it in a different way, but I think I'm going to say the same thing, which is right now, and I'll put like, let's put the historical context of other disruptive technologies, right? EVAR started as what you do to the guy that's going to die if you put him on the table. Mm-hmm. TAVR started as a procedure you do for somebody that is non-surgical and they'll die on the table. Look at both of those now, right? I mean, they're widely spread. You do them in patients that are appropriate and okay risk. that would otherwise do fine with open surgery, but it's become something that is okay and it can be well tolerated. So I think we may move from the no option to the poor option. What do you mean poor option? Well, I mean, poor option means anything that doesn't last more than 3 months. And like it or hate it, that's where we are with below the knee interventions. We know a third of what we do is down by 3 months, a third by 6 months, and the rest thereafter. And the one thing that this thing is different from everything else, every other tool we have, I don't think anybody can say that there's one tool that we use that when the patency dies, when the patency is down, the patient is better off than when they started. This technology, I mean, it is still part of these.
Not all the time, but sometimes. Yeah, for sure.
Okay. I would say most of the time.
A lot of the time. Yeah.
Most of the time. This has been my experience through over 100 cases, I would say probably in the last few years, but these things end up occluding. Okay. Mm-hmm. I meet the patient very ischemic. I like to do an arterialization. Everything comes back to life. You get them through the TMA, you get them into remission or whatever is healed. Then you start seeing signs of occlusion or poor flow. And then the thing goes down. Guess what? The baseline perfusion and the end perfusion after the occlusion, there is a delta. Yeah. I am not saying that it's huge, but it's enough. And we know that a lot of these patients, all they need is 0.1 or 0.2 more in their ABIs to get out of CLTI. And so for whatever reason, angiogenesis, recruitment of hibernating vessels, whatever that's happening, something happens because even the DVA down, you put that Doppler on the foot and it's blowing. Like, I cannot explain it. And I think most of us have seen it on angiography. You see collaterals, you see a lot of recruitment, you see a lot of patterns that are not normal, even in the setting of an occlusion. So you don't have to chase eternal patency with this device, which is really lovely. Because to your point, maybe you do a complex anterior tibial angioplasty, right? A long CTO that you know will last 3 months, but maybe you add a DVA on the background that's going to create a sustainable long-term thing. And so once the AT goes down, the DVA has done its job, patient ends up in a better place. I don't know. But that's to me what may sound, and I think we're going to learn how to do these very low flow fistulas that stay open, that don't create a ton of ischemia on the front end, and maybe something very interesting to look down the line. Mike,
what do you think, Mike?
Yeah.
Sorry,
go ahead. I think, Miguel, you hit the nail right on the head. What I say to my fellows is, like, we transform the arterial architecture of the foot, right? That's what these patients, to the patients who respond to the arterialization of deep veins, is I would say that there probably are some patients who are non-responders or slow responders. There are patients who are superficial system dominant as opposed to deep system dominant. But if you, when you have success with these procedures and the TADV or DVA does go down, and you, for whatever reason, find yourself doing another intervention, maybe it's on the contralateral leg, and you sheet your ipsilateral leg, you know, just to see what that foot looks like despite healing, it's pretty remarkable, the new blood vessels that obviously have no names, that develop. Like, it's to me, it looks like a spider web has, like, grown over the foot. And it feels good. Not only because you prevented an amputation, patient still has their foot, right? It feels good because, like Miguel said, it's like you've done something that's going to protect your patient from, you know, redeveloping a wound on that leg. So, yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And I mean, that's, you know, when you look at the Clarity data and you look at the combined PROMISE 1, PROMISE 2 data, like, patients who are deprived of this type of intervention, not only do they get more amputations, they die more.
Yeah.
The mortality is higher, their amputation-free survival is lower, and the patients who do get this intervention, despite the shortcomings in patency, they keep their legs and they live. And I think that's the thing that's really, you know, lights a fire under my butt when I think about DVA. Yeah.
And then you can't really argue anymore that they were going to die anyways at the same rate. Keeping the leg is beneficial. It gives you, the patient, a longer life, more quality of life. And that really like cements that argument and kind of cast out that other argument that, oh, these patients are going to die anyways in 2 years. Like, why are we fighting so much to save this leg? It's like, no, the leg gives the patient quality and quantity for sure.
Yeah, I think.
All right, fellas, we're coming up.
Sorry.
I'm sorry. Sean, go ahead.
No, I was just, I just thought that was a really excellent point Lucas just made. And it's why we sometimes measure the endpoints of the work on this patient group is amputation-free survival, right? So staying alive and keeping your leg are both important things. I think I'm really glad you asked the question. I don't think it's insane. I think it's controversial in 2024 to talk about going upstream, perhaps, on the Rutherford scale. But you can imagine it doesn't take a lot to get to a point where you can imagine a better solution for upstream patients than what we have now. And maybe it involves product development that allows flow maintenance in these procedures. Maybe it involves change in flow volumes, as Miguel alluded to. Maybe it involves better understanding of the mechanisms of action. There's a lot of really neat projects in that world now. But those aren't like unimaginable steps. Do you know what I mean? And so I hope people are dreaming about that, because that's what we need to move the needle for these patients, so that they don't get to the point where they become a no option only phenotype. But thankfully, we have a good solution for them now that we didn't have before. So sorry, Miguel, I just thought it was a great point Lucas made.
No. I thought you wrapped that fantastically well. And I want to say to our audience, thank you for sticking around. To our guests, thank you for coming, man. This was a great conversation with great dynamic and just lots of good perspectives from different sides of a very important problem that we deal with on a daily basis. And with that, I give you back your day. I appreciate your being here, and we'll see you hopefully another time here at the Life of Flow podcast, guys. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, guys. This is awesome.
Much appreciated.
All right.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.